Alaska's a long ways away from any sort of earthquake early warning system.
The federal government announces an early warning system for earthquakes, but not in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the only insurer left on Alaska's individual market has a proposal to stabilize rates.
Make it more attractive for carriers to come in. And so if things stabilize and the market gets more attractive, that can really help consumer choice.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting Alaska's workforce and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Interior Secretary Sally Jewell today announced the start of an earthquake early warning system called Shake Alert. It's in beta testing now, but Jewell says soon West Coast residents will be able to participate in a prototype that will send alerts to their cell phones a few seconds to a few minutes before a big quake strikes. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the warnings won't cover Alaska.
Japan already has an earthquake warning system. So do China and Turkey. But California Congressman Adam Schiff says he deployed the technology first.
I was the original early earthquake warning system. I gave accurate and precise information about when an earthquake was going to hit, and it was proved to be fully accurate. I did this well before any other country employed this kind of system.
The congressman says it was in the 1990s. Schiff was in L.A. on the phone with his brother, who was in a different part of the city.
And I said, whoa, did you feel that? And he said, what? And then he said, whoa.
Schiff's story at a White House earthquake summit was meant to be funny, but actually, that's kind of how an earthquake early warning works. Sensors would detect an earthquake near the epicenter, prompting a warning message. If that message can travel to someone in the path of the earthquake faster than the wave of energy rippling through the earth, that person would have an early warning. How early depends on how far you are from the point of detection, among other factors. Secretary Jewell says the system will do more than send life-saving cell phone alerts to individuals.
But also elevators to stop and open at a floor, fire station doors to open so that those first responders can get out, trains to stop or to slow down before they get into harm's way. All of these basic things will be facilitated by this work that's going on for Shake Alert.
Shake Alert is the name of the prototype system developed for California, Oregon, and Washington, which will cost an estimated $16 million a year to run. A lot of the work was done at universities, but the U.S. Geological Survey is running it. Jewell did mention Alaska at the White House conference.
I did ask my team, well, where's Alaska? Alaska's very earthquake prone. They said, we'd love to have a partnership with the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, Anchorage, whomever.
It wasn't clear what it would take to get that partnership. In a phone call afterward, Jewell said it would require some investment.
There's an incremental cost to extending it to the state of Alaska that would need to be covered somehow. It could be federal money, could be state money, could be private money, a combination thereof.
Jewell did not know what the cost would be, and she said there's nothing for an Alaska extension in the budget the administration is about to release. John Vidali, director of the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network, sees few barriers to extending the system.
Let's see, Alaska certainly is ideal for such a system, and there are a lot of seismometers up there. It's really a matter of bringing the software and the 24-hour attention to the system, and so it's probably one of the four or five next places in line.
Alaska's a long ways away from any sort of earthquake early warning system.
State seismologist Michael West sees it differently.
For earthquake early warning to be successful, you need to build it on top of, this is an add-on to a strong, resilient, robust earthquake monitoring system. At present, the earthquake monitoring system in Alaska in my opinion, does not have a strong enough foundation on which we could build earthquake early warning, at least not in a short time frame.
West says, among other things, the state needs fast, reliable data communication networks that can, well, survive an earthquake. And he says it needs more sensors. He's campaigning for the state to keep an array of some 200 seismographic stations now going into the state as part of a National Science Foundation project.
Well, Alaska's a little different than the lower 48 in that a tremendous expense and energy and a lot of brain power is going into installing these sites in places where we've never had good seismic recordings.
West says it's a $40 million endeavor and the stations are only intended to be in Alaska for about 5 years.
To me, it seems like a tremendous loss for that equipment to move on somewhere else when, frankly, we could assume ownership and operate it in situ, you know, in place for a fraction of the cost of what it would take to actually install it from scratch.
West, though, says the sensors are gathering information for longer-term science. He says it would be a significant technical undertaking to patch them into the state's earthquake monitoring system, let alone any kind of early warning network. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott signed the state marijuana regulations into law last month, and the state will begin accepting license applications on February 24th. But there's a wrench in the works. The original bill fails to properly authorize background checks. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
Before the Marijuana Control Board can issue licenses to anybody, the FBI requires a background check. It's a way of determining if an applicant has received a felony conviction in the last 5 years in another state. If the answer is yes, no license may be awarded. But the original bill is missing the enabling language that would allow the FBI to run names and fingerprints in the first place. Cynthia Franklin, the director of the Marijuana Control Board, says that in order to award that power, it will take a state statute.
The FBI requires an enabling statute to run a name through the National Criminal History Database, and a regulation is not enough.
The Alaska Department of Public Safety notified the Marijuana Control Board of this oversight in October. She explains the language should have been inserted into HB 123, which created the Marijuana Control Board. It was brought up as a floor amendment, but ultimately didn't make it in.
So it was discovered well after session. So they missed a spot.
Furthermore, the Department of Public Safety is missing its necessary authorization to do background checks, as it does for liquor licenses. Franklin says that in order for licenses to be issued in June, the legislature must fill these legal loopholes fast.
And if those things do not happen this session, then we will be in a very sticky place because we will have a statute that says we can't issue licenses to individuals who have a felony conviction within the last 5 years, but we will only be able to check Alaska criminal histories. We will not be able to check out-of-state criminal histories. So we may have someone say, yeah, I don't have any felony convictions in the last 5 years, but we won't have any way of knowing whether that's a true statement or not.
To close this security gap, the Senate Rules Committee is interested in rewriting HB 75, a marijuana cleanup bill from last session, and folding in the necessary statutory language. The bill was originally drafted in the House Community and Regional Affairs Standing Committee, chaired by Representative Kathy Tilton. An aide for Tilton, Heath Hilliard, told KCAW by email that the Senate is on their own timeline, but that the bill may see movement on the floor next week. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
BP announced another round of layoffs today as plunging oil prices take a toll on the major producers. But a spokesperson says this round of cuts will not affect Alaska. The company will cut 3,000 positions from its worldwide marketing and refining operations. That comes on top of the 4,000 layoffs BP announced last month in its global production and exploration units. In all, the company still expects to cut about 260 jobs in Alaska this year, or 13% of its workforce. The Department of Labor is predicting Alaska will lose about 1,000 oil and gas jobs this year after employment in the industry hit a record high in 2015. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the history of the Yukon Quest, which starts this Saturday.
you could say effectively that Jujiro Wada did the first Yukon quest, if you will.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Today is the deadline set by the Legislative Council to figure out what to do with the controversial lease on the Legislative Information Office in downtown Anchorage. In December, the council set a 45-day limit to decide whether or not to break a 10-year lease with the building's owner. As of today, the office of Senator Gary Stevens, a Republican from Kodiak and chair of the council, says it has received materials relevant to the decision. Stevens' office declined to specify what those materials are, but says they expect to release information later in the week. What the Legislative Council recommends to the full body of lawmakers has the potential to shape what happens to the LIO building and tens of millions of dollars in state funds. Critics say the 10-year lease deal was inappropriately negotiated and profits the development company at the expense of taxpayers. The developer says the lease agreement was approved by lawmakers at a below-market rate in 2013 and that legislators are reneging on a tougher economic climate. The LIO building is also at the heart of a lawsuit brought forward by a neighboring business. The Legislative Council could meet as early as next week to vet the materials and make a recommendation. The future of the LIO lease is pegged to a budget appropriation. The legislature may also be able to buy the building outright. Primera Alaska is the only individual health insurer left in the state. Moda Health withdrew from the market last week after Oregon regulators revealed the company was facing enormous financial losses. Before Moda's announcement, Primera and Moda were working together on a plan to stabilize Alaska's individual market. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
Rates for insurance on healthcare.gov have increased an average of 70% in Alaska over the last 2 years. The state now has the highest average premiums in the country by a wide margin. But those high rates aren't paying the bills. Primera says they lost more than $13 million serving Alaska's individual market in 2014 and expects to lose a similar amount for 2015.
These are all just signs pointing to this crisis, I think, that the individual market is in.
Sheila Tallman, Primera's legislative manager, is working on a plan to pull the individual market out of crisis. Alaska's individual market is small, about 22,000 people, according to recent figures released by the federal government. Tallman says there aren't enough Alaskans buying individual insurance plans to absorb the really big claims from the sickest members in the insurance pool.
We're trying to find ways to spread the risk of the individual market in Alaska to a broader population.
Primera wants to take those large health claims for things like chronic heart failure or some types of cancer treatments and send them into a separate high-risk pool. That pool already exists. It's called the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, or ACHIA. The state administers the pool, and it's paid for by a tax on employer health plans in Alaska. Primera is funding a study that will look at how much that tax will amount to under different scenarios in their proposal. Alaska's insurance director, Lori Wing-Heyer, says she can't support the proposal until she sees that report.
Because basically, this bill is asking all Alaskans to be assessed to subsidize the individual market to stabilize premiums. And I think we have to have a number to say that's what the cost is going to be.
The report is expected to be released next week. In the meantime, Wing-Heyer says she's setting up meetings with health insurers to try to bring new companies to the state's individual market. But how hard is it to convince insurers to set up shop in Alaska?
I would say in the current environment, without making any changes, it would be very difficult.
Louise Norris is a health insurance broker in Colorado who writes about health exchanges in every state for healthinsurance.org. She says Alaska should consider proposals like Primera's as a way to entice other companies into the market.
Just because other carriers are going to see, you know, that Primera has been losing money on the individual market, and obviously so has Moda, and that it's, you know, it's a challenging environment.
Primera says the program isn't likely to decrease rates on Alaska's individual market, but it should put an end to the massive increases the market has endured since the launch of healthcare.gov. Melanie Kuhn is a spokesperson for Primera. She says besides stabilizing rates, the program should encourage competition in the market.
What we're proposing in Alaska in the reinsurance program, we want to make it more attractive for carriers to come in. And so if things stabilize and the market gets more attractive, that can really help consumer choice.
Primera's proposal requires legislation. The company is working to find a state lawmaker to sponsor a bill this session. Primera would like to have the program in place before they have to file their rate increase for 2017. That deadline is this spring. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Governor Bill Walker announced 5 nominations to the State Board of Fish and Game today. On the list again this year for a fish board seat is Robert Ruffner of Kenai, who would replace Fritz Johnson, a commercial fisherman from Dillingham. If confirmed, it will be the first time the fish board would not have a member from Bristol Bay. KDLG's Molly Dishner has more.
News of the governor's appointments to the fish board fell with a thud in the home of the world's largest sockeye salmon fishery.
You know, this is a sad day for Bristol Bay. I mean, fisheries is everybody's livelihood in Bristol Bay, and I'm very disappointed in the governor's action.
That's Robin Samuelson, a lifelong Bristol Bay fisherman who wears many hats in the region. Remember when President Obama stopped in Dillingham? It was Samuelson who rode with him in the limo during the 3-hour tour. Samuelson had just gotten to Juneau when the nominations were announced and said he was headed to pay Governor Walker a visit shortly after. Bristol Bay has come to expect a seat at the table, and that Walker was opting not to reappoint Fritz Johnson of Dillingham was a clear disappointment.
I feel like the governor stabbed Bristol Bay in the back. We've had a board of fish member from Bristol Bay since a little after statehood. I could see him replacing Fritz, but it would seem that with having the biggest herring fishery in the state of Alaska, having the biggest salmon fishery in the world, that would be afforded a board of fish member that's knowledgeable about the fishery.
Johnson, a drift fisherman in the bay, was appointed to the board in 2013, replacing Vince Webster of King Salmon. The bay's lineage on the Board of Fish does date to 1975, when the Fish and Game Boards were split. Johnson made news in 2015 when he was cited for commercial fishing 3 minutes past a closure. He pleaded guilty and was fined $1,500 for the violation. The incident wasn't good optics for a member of the board that sets fisheries regulations. Was it bad enough to block his reappointment? Walker says not necessarily.
That's been brought up, but that wasn't a deciding factor for me.
In Johnson's place, Walker tapped Robert Ruffner, former executive director of the nonprofit Kenai Watershed Forum.
I just wanted a little bit different balance, not necessarily of user groups, but a regional balance a little bit. Certainly wouldn't look at this as a trend in any way, but I think that there's a lot of angst in the Cook Inlet Peninsula region, and I looked at the individual, both were quite obviously quite good. Fritz is very good. He's been a good board member, and I look at Robert Ruffner, and I look at his. I think what he brings to the board, and I just felt I needed to have a little bit of a shift.
That was fitting for Groundhog's Day. Walker put Ruffner up last year, but he was blocked by resistance from the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association, which wanted someone with a stronger sport fishing background. But Walker says this time around, he's confident Ruffner's appointment will go through. Walker's other nominees include Alan Kane, a former wildlife trooper to replace Robert Mumford, who announced he's resigning in March. And Israel Payton was tapped to replace Tom Kluberton, who's not seeking another term after his expires in June. On the game side, Walker named Guy Trimmingham and Nathan Turner. All those picks are still subject to confirmation by the legislature. In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. At Alaska Pacific University, you will be inspired by the beauty of Alaska, motivated by devoted faculty, and surrounded by independent-minded, creative students pursuing their higher education goals. There's no time like the present to find out what they are all about. It's time to experience APU. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Law enforcement officials are investigating two shooting deaths near Wasilla. The victims are identified as Renee Millard, age 40, and 10-year-old Dean Millard. Alaska State Troopers were alerted to the sound of gunfire at a rural residence in the Meadow Lakes area sometime after 8 a.m. on Monday. According to Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters, two people in an Autumn Lane residence were found deceased shortly afterward. Troopers said in a dispatch today that the Alaska Bureau of Investigation is taking over the homicide investigation. Trooper spokesperson Peters says the initial 911 call was made by another juvenile living at the residence. A dog in the home was taken into protective custody and later claimed by an authorized person. Peters said today, troopers believe there is no danger to the community. On Monday, two elementary schools in the area were placed on stay-put mode, but classes continued. The stay-put order was lifted Monday evening. Fairbanks has been exceptionally dry over the last 2 months. A total of just 1.9 inches of snow fell at the airport in December and January, besting Fairbanks' previous low mark for the 2 months set in the winter of 1952 and 53. National Weather Service lead meteorologist Christopher Cox attributes the snow drought to El Nino-driven high pressure.
A large ridge of high pressure that's built up over the eastern interior and west coast of Canada. And that's a direct result of the very powerful El Nino that we have ongoing. So that blocking ridge has basically blocked the storms to the south of us, and we just have not received the precipitation here in the interior.
A foot of snow remains on the ground at the airport, the result of a seasonal total that has so far not suffered due to heavy precipitation events last fall.
Since the 1st of July, we've had 52.0 inches of snow, which is 3.8 inches above the normal 48.2 inches, which we would expect through the 1st of January. And that's thanks in large part to the record-breaking snow that we had in September and November of 2015.
Cox says the El Nino conditions that later shut off precipitation also elevated temperatures above normal last month.
The coldest temperature for the month of January was 20 below, and that happened on the 16th. And that low temperature was the third warmest low temperature for the month of January in the climatic record.
Cox says January's average low was 6 below, nearly 11 degrees above normal, while the average high was 13 degrees, 12 above normal. He says warm and dry conditions are forecast to continue. The 2016 Yukon Quest gets underway in Fairbanks this Saturday, with 23 teams running 1,000 miles to Whitehorse. As KUAC's Molly Reddig reports, dog teams will be traversing a trail rooted in history.
In 1902, a few days after Christmas, Jujiro Wada left Fairbanks with a team of sled dogs headed for Dawson City. Wada was originally from Japan. He was working as a cook for E.T. Barnett, who had just set up a trading post on the Chena River. He was going to Dawson to announce that gold had been discovered in Fairbanks, hoping to start a stampede to the new town.
You could say effectively that Jujiro Wada did the first Yukon Quest, if you will.
Marty Sturry is the Alaska Executive Director for the Yukon Quest. The trail runs 1,000 miles from Fairbanks to Whitehorse, following the Yukon River most of the way. Today it's known as one of the toughest sled dog races in the world, but it started out as a winter highway between gold rush communities.
When you drive to Alaska from the lower 48, it is this constant mystery as you drive on why these roads are here and why are these towns here. And it's because you have to look at it more globally and recognize that everything was actually populated by way of the rivers, not of the roads.
During his journey, the cook stayed in rest cabins along the river that were built to supply fuel to the riverboats. Boats were the only way to get around in the summer, and they needed a lot of wood to keep their boilers going. During the winter, the riverboat companies paid locals to stockpile firewood along the Yukon.
There were cabins built every 30, 40 miles, which was how far a dog team could run in a day, where they would be there and they would cut down trees and get paid to supply wood for these sternwheelers.
When they heard news of the Nugget, hundreds of miners left Dawson for Fairbanks. It was the beginning of the Fairbanks gold rush. As more people moved to interior Alaska, the trail got even busier. The U.S. Postal Service delivered mail to all the little towns, like Eagle, Circle, Central, and Fairbanks. The mail carriers had always used horses in the other states, but they needed a different animal for the north.
There's no way for horses or larger animals to graze like there would be, say, with the Pony Express in the lower 48. So dogs who can eat fish, eat our meat, basically eat the same diet that we do, were our beasts of burden.
For years, mail carriers ran the trails with their dog teams, battling cold weather and dangerous ice to get the mail through. Around 1940, airplanes finally replaced sled dogs as the main mode of transportation in the bush. The trails languished for a while, but in 1984, a group of dog mushers and history buffs decided to bring them back to life.
There's been travel on these by dog team forever. It's just that we took the step of connecting them.
Today, the Yukon Quest celebrates the prospectors, mail carriers, trappers, and their dogs that helped settle Alaska more than a century ago. The 33rd Yukon Quest starts in Fairbanks on Saturday at 11 a.m. In Fairbanks, I'm Molly Redig.
Saturday's Yukon Quest start is being relocated due to rough ice conditions on the Chena River in downtown Fairbanks. Race organizers say the start chute will shift from its traditional spot on the ice near the Cushman Street Bridge several hundred yards upriver to solid ground behind the Morris Thompson Center. From there, dog teams will drop onto the Chena in an area where ice conditions are better. 23 teams are slated to compete in the 1,000-mile event, which begins at 11 on Saturday. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Emily Kwong in Sitka, Rachel Waldholtz, Zachariah Hughes and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Molly Dishner in Dillingham, and Dan Bross and Molly Redig in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The Elder Mentor Program brings the wisdom of Alaskan elders into the classrooms and the communities across the state. Elders age 55 and older share their compassion, social support, and cultural values with the next generation. Earn a small stipend while supporting the educational staff and children. Alaska's Elder Mentors serve through the National Senior Corps Program. Mentor information at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.